This is Ruth Blue interviewing Mandy Masters on the 30th of November 2012 at her home in Grays in Essex for Thalidomide and Oral History Project. Mm-hmm. Mandy, have you seen and signed the copyright and consent form?
Yes, I have.
And could you start off by telling me your full name, age, date and place of birth?
Okay, my name is Mandy Lorraine Masters. What else is it you want to know? My date of birth?
Yep, date and place of birth.
Okay, my date of birth is the 20th of September 1961 and I was born at Orsett in Grays in Essex.
First of all, the first few questions are about your childhood, your birth, your family and school life and any early medical interventions. So could you start off by saying a little bit about your family background, who your parents were,
yeah,
what sort of work they did, and if you have any siblings?
Yeah, okay. my mum and dad, who are Len Hornsby and June Hornsby, I do have siblings. They have three brothers and two sisters, but one has recently died, so I've only got one sister now. My dad was, he used to build concrete garages for Bisons, and obviously my mum spent time at home with us.
Mm. So she was a stay-at-home mum?
Yeah. Until she got older, and then she started to train to be a staff nurse. And then when my nephew got murdered, it all went wrong, and she just gave up.
Okay. Okay, we'll go back to that one.
Yeah.
And moving on to your parents' decision to use thalidomide, do you know who prescribed the drug for your mum?
Yeah, oh, what was the doctor's name? Dr. Sandilan.
And do you know what it was prescribed for?
Yeah, she couldn't sleep. It was the sleeping.
Yeah.
Some took it because of sickness.
Yeah.
And she took it because of not sleeping.
Okay, so insomnia. And do you know how long she took it for?
No.
Is it something she was happy to talk about, the fact that she'd taken the drug, or was it something that she felt was a difficult subject for her to talk about?
We've never actually, I must admit, we've never really spoke about it.
Mm.
Never really. All I know is my dad was saying that it's a good job they kept a prescription because, first of all, the doctor was saying he didn't give it to her. And they had a prescription.
That's interesting. So the doctor said you were never prescribed it,
yeah,
but she'd kept hold
yeah
of it. Yeah.
So that was good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've never really had an in-depth conversation with my mum about it, you know, because I don't know. I think I was always worried in case it would be sad for her. One thing she always was worried about, if ever I blamed her, which one thing I would never do, you know, so she was worried in case there was times in my life growing up that I would blame her.
Mm.
So,
where did you fall into the, you mentioned your siblings, but where did you fall into the line of siblings?
I come on the fifth.
Okay, you were the fifth child.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason my mum had another one after me is she kind of got it into her head that she would never be able to have another normal baby. And the doctor said the only way you will get this out of your mind is to have another child.
Mm.
So that's where my younger sister came in.
Okay, so after you.
Yeah, but I was a twin actually.
Really?
Yeah, my mum lost the first, which she thought she'd lost the whole baby. And they said, no, there was me, so there was, you know, I was a twin.
That's interesting, isn't it?
But she always felt, with the other pregnancies, she was always fine. And she did say to me that she used to say to her mum, there's something the matter with this baby.
Mm-hmm.
And her mum used to say, don't be silly.
Mm.
And my mum kept thinking I was going to be a Down syndrome. And she kept saying, there's something the matter.
Mm.
No, and obviously not expecting me to be born without arms.
Mm.
And I did, because I'm now writing my own book, obviously I'm having to ask things about me when I was born.
Yeah.
And I find more that my dad tells me more, because obviously I see a lot more of my dad.
Yeah.
And he said that when my mum got taken into hospital, my dad was at work.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd got a phone call saying, you know, that it was the hospital and a baby daughter had been born, but there's a problem.
Mm.
So, you know, my dad said, what do you mean there's a problem? And they said, well, your baby's got some deformities and we need you to come over. And when he got over there, he said, has my wife seen the baby? And they said no. So he was livid at the fact that they'd straight away took me from my mum without even saying why they took me.
Mm.
And I think they wanted my dad to go in and tell my mum. And, you know, my dad said, but you're going to have to come in there and explain what's the matter.
Mm.
So they did. And obviously they then brought me in and showed my parents my deformities. But my dad, mum and dad said straight away that it doesn't matter, you know. They loved me straight from day one.
Mm.
But they were given the option, you know, you don't have to take her home. We can take her away now and you can have her put in a home. Because a lot got put away. And that's one thing they didn't want.
Mm.
And then obviously my dad went home to tell my my sister then and my three brothers, because they were obviously dying to find out what their mum had had. And he went home and he sat them down and he said, you know, you've got a baby sister. He said, but there is something wrong with her. And he told them that, you know, I had no arms. And one of my brothers, when I was just chatting with him about it, I said, like, you know, he said, oh, when Dad came home and told us, he said, we were dying to see what you look like, because we couldn't imagine that somebody didn't have arms. So the day that they brought me home, my mum placed me on the floor. She took my shoe off and took my clothes off so that they could see, you know. And then once they'd seen, they just got on with going and playing, didn't bother them. And from that day, I was brought up a very, very normal child, you know. And my mum said at 6 months old, she said I was laying in the pram and she was busy washing up, and there was a newspaper at the bottom of the pram. And she could hear rustling. And when she's come in to have a look, she said, my feet were rustling this paper. So then she kind of thought, maybe I should get her to start using her toes.
Mm-hmm.
So she said she had the plastic rollers, you know, the old-fashioned and plastic rollers. And she said she put them on my toes and I used to wiggle them about. And then from that, you know... doing that, then it was other things. And at 9 months old, I was standing.
Wow.
You see, when the doctors were talking to my parents about me and my life, they did say she may not survive, you know, she may only reach 19. She basically wouldn't do much, be a cabbage, I suppose. They said she probably wouldn't have children. And, you know, as time went on, I've kind of conquered it all, done it all.
And proved them totally wrong. Yeah.
And the best thing, you know, obviously getting married, you know, because it was a worry. I can't remember much of being 14, you see. There was a big blank to my life then. And my mum said I was going through such a depression. And I can only think that it's a time when girls, you know, you're 14, probably worried was I'm not ever going to get a boyfriend.
Yes.
You know, so that little bit of my life went blank.
Yeah.
But yeah, to get married and to have children, the best bit was the grandchildren. Because that was, like I say, that is the cherry on the cake, to have the grandchildren.
Absolutely.
You know, so... I can remember being really young and not wanting to pull my knickers up. I can remember shouting from the toilet saying, I've finished. And my mum would say, will you pull your knickers up?
Yeah.
I don't want to. And then she said, you know, well, then you stay there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I said to her once, I said, I thought you were so cruel. And she said, yes, she said, but you didn't see me cry. She said, I used to break my heart when I made you do things. She said, I broke my heart. She said, but if we had mollycoddled you and done everything for you, I wouldn't be what I am now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, great parents.
I think that makes all the difference, actually, from what I've understood so far. Because this is an oral history interview, and it's not a visual interview, could you describe for anybody listening to it what your level of impairment is?
What do you mean? What?
How were you born?
Oh, right. Yes, I have the only... I have one finger on my right side. I have nothing to left. And that's it. I always said I could have done with another little finger, the other side, because when it was windy, to keep my coat on, it was handy having a little finger.
Just to hook things over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it would have been handy to have one the other side.
Yeah. And do you know... So your parents were aware that you'd been born with an impairment right from the start.
Yes.
And they said, we want her anyway.
Yes.
Do you know if they were given any help or advice or support by medical professionals at that time?
Not straight away.
Yeah. Okay. And you went straight home from hospital.
Yes.
And you mentioned you were sort of automatically brought into the family.
Yeah.
And brought into the sort of sibling environment. Mm-hmm. So would you say in general that you had like a sort of a reasonably happy childhood?
Yes. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Even, you know, going to school, I mean, my mum had to really fight to get me into a normal school because some of the local schools wouldn't take me. And then she went to this one particular school, spoke to the headmistress, and she said, well, we can give it a go. You know, and what I find really it's lovely now, my grandson's actually going to the same school that I went to, you know, and I think, oh, it's lovely. But yeah, I had such a happy childhood. I couldn't say that I was unhappy at all.
Yeah.
You know, because they brought me up so to be as everyone else. I mean, I hate the word normal because we are all normal.
I know, it's so difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
What alternative word is there? I mean, I never know. I'm always kind of going, so compared to normal people, you're kind of like, well, you know, who is the normal person? Mm.
But I was always determined to do things my way. You know, if somebody said, oh, well, I can't do that, then I would want to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I would want to try everything.
Yes, yeah.
And of course, when my mum and dad got put in touch with Roehampton and about artificial arms. I remember seeing a picture of me, what they call dolly arms, and I must have only been about one or two. And obviously they were just for show, really. But my mum said one thing that she never wanted was for me to stop using my feet. Because, you know, it's important that I still had something to fall back on if I didn't adapt to the arms. And, you know, I have tried many times to wear them, you know, giving them up and then going back to them. It was just like being a robot, really. You know,
and they were very heavy as well, weren't they?
Yes, yeah, they were ridiculously heavy. The gas cylinders, you know, we used to have to wear a belt around the waist and have cylinders on each hip.
Yeah.
And then they developed where the cylinder went into the arm. But it was still, they still wasn't right.
Do you know, have any idea at what point your parents knew that your impairment had been caused by thalidomide?
I don't know.
No. Yeah. Because you know, at the point a lot of children were born, parents didn't know at that moment, you know, why the impairments had happened. And it was only later that knowledge of thalidomide sort of came in.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
No, okay.
I've never gone into depth with them.
Yeah, okay. No, that's fair enough. Do you know if your parents were involved with the Thalidomide Society or any of the other groups that were
going
on?
Yes, I remember that my parents did, and they went to lots and lots of meetings. Yeah, because I've recently seen old clips of papers, and they've put on there, does anybody know who these parents are? And I was shocked. I'm thinking, oh my God, they're mine. You know, but yes, they went to many, many meetings to fight for compensation.
Yeah.
I know my dad said the first time it was a ridiculous offer of compensation, and you know, they really did fight. But, you know, I don't know how many they went to, but I know they'd met other, obviously other thalidomide parents, you know, people that had the same sort of disability. And, it was a frustrating time for them.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
But, and there was also Lady Hall.
The Lady Hall Trust.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet her that you remember?
I can't remember her. I think I must have, because we went somewhere, what was vivid in my mind, I remember getting on this coach, like a horse carriage coach, and we went to meet the Hollies, and this was all to do with Lady Hall. We went to this big place, and the Hollies were there, and Sandy Shore, and but I can remember the big coach and going on that with the horses. But I can't remember if Lady Hall
herself. Yeah.
But I think we must have.
She did a lot, didn't she? Really, at that point in time.
Yeah.
And what about meeting other families and children that were affected by thalidomide?
I obviously don't remember when I was younger, but my parents obviously did. The first time I ever met another thalidomide. My mum kept trying to get me to go on these holidays that the Thalidomide Trust had set up, and I kept refusing all the time. And then at 16, she said, like, there was this holiday going to Switzerland. She said, and it's, you know, you can go, and there'd be other thalidomides there. And obviously I said, okay. And we'd gone to Heathrow Airport, not the airport, the hotel, and in the bar, I never forget, because there was all these, oh, I shouldn't say odd people, because I'm one of them, but
they would still be odd to you
at
that point.
Yes, because I'd never ever seen anybody else.
Yeah.
And I was shocked, because I'd never seen anybody with no arms and legs and little hands and all different shapes and sizes. Mm. And they were drinking and smoking and, you know, at that time I wouldn't even swear, do you know what I mean? So I must have lived quite a little bit of a shallow life, and they were like, I was just shocked. And then I'm thinking, oh my God, I don't want to stay. Mm. And I knew my mum and dad were going to be leaving me there. Mm. So that was quite a scary time, actually.
Yeah.
And then as the holiday went and we were getting to become friends, I kind of thought, you know what, you know, there was some worse off than me.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm not as bad, because I could do lots of things then.
Mm.
You know, I could completely dress myself, do everything. Mm. So it was an eye opener. And then obviously I got to then decide to go to Hague Moor in Jersey.
Yes.
You see, and that's where I met more of them. So it was a very strange experience.
Did you find it kind of useful for you though to be in that environment with other people affected by thalidomide in the same way?
Sometimes, but sometimes a bit depressing.
Yes.
Because some of them, obviously the ones that hadn't had a home, could be quite depressing.
Mm.
You know, there was some that expected people to do things for them, their helpers.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Where most of the time I did everything myself, so I didn't want to be around them all the time.
Yes.
Again, the word normal's going to come up here, because I had a normal life with normal friends.
Yes.
So it wasn't going to be my cup of tea to always be with them.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so you went to a, going back to the prosthetic thing, mm-hmm. so you went to Roehampton for a while, mm-hmm. and they tried to get you to use prosthetic arms, yeah. but you weren't happy with those.
No, and my dad was saying there was one time he did specifically say to them, you are not to put shoes on her. You are not to put shoes.
Yeah.
And when they came to pick me up, my dad said that he'd noticed that I'd got really tight strap marks on my feet. So he obviously pulled one of the nurses up and said, you know, these are shoe marks. And they said, we had to put her shoes on because she was refusing to use the hands. So we had to make her wear her shoes. And he wasn't happy with that at all.
That's very restricting, isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah. Yeah. And as I got to know more, as I started to get older and going to Roehampton, I hated it.
Yeah.
And I was only talking to my dad about a month ago when I've started my book and I'm having to obviously type my memories.
Yeah.
The thought of Roehampton, it's awful.
Mm.
I said, I can't go to a hospital now and hear lockers. I know it sounds really silly, but when I hear somebody undo a locker, that little click and seeing lockers brings back memories of when they used to leave me and my mum used to put all my stuff in the locker.
Yeah.
That's a sad memory for me.
Mm.
And tiny blue lights, that's a sad memory of Roehampton, lying in the hospital bed, and when the tiny lights come on and we knew it was bedtime, and it was horrible feelings. And, you know, of course my dad said to me a month ago, he said, I hope you don't hold that against us, though. Mm. We thought we were doing it for your good.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I said, well, the day they got me out of that hospital, I'd had a little bit to do with, and this, I think I must have been about 13.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd been a little bit younger. And I was in the school room at Roehampton.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody had spilt some paint. We were painting things on their glass windows, and paint had been spilled, and somebody said I'd done it, and I'd refused to clean it up. So I'd had a real sort of ding dong with the Sister Mears that.
Sister Mears.
I can't even stand the thought of her.
Okay, yes. So you have bad memories of Sister Mears. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people love Sister Mears.
I have to say, I've only ever heard, like, really, like, everybody loves her.
Not me.
No.
No, not as I got older. And I got locked in my bedroom until they phoned my parents up because I got really uncontrollable.
Mm.
And they said, you know, she's really, you need to come up. And, you know, when my parents come up and they said, you know, she's never coming back here. I said to my dad, you don't realise that was a big, big weight lifted from me for you to say she's never coming back.
Yeah.
And I couldn't wait to get out of that hospital.
Yeah.
The only little, there was a little midget nurse called Murphy. And whenever my mum and dad had to drop me off there and leave me there, I always knew they were going to go because Murphy would come along and she'd go to me, come on, let's go and watch telly. So I knew mum and dad were going.
Mm-hmm.
So the only good memory I had was little Murphy. But I'm, you know, I see a picture of Sister Mears on Facebook, and oh, I cringed. I thought, that woman.
That's so interesting to hear you say that, because you are the first person who's ever said anything negative about her at all.
Yeah, no. So me and her certainly
didn't click.
No.
No.
I guess. As a child, I was quite outspoken. I still am now.
Yeah.
I don't let anybody bully me.
Yeah.
Even as a child, I wouldn't. I think it's because I've been brought up with a big family.
Yeah.
And maybe I was too outspoken.
And she reacted against that.
Yeah. You know.
It's a possibility. You never know, do you?
No.
And so primary school education, you went to a mainstream primary school.
Yes. Yeah.
And did the school make any special provisions for you whilst you were there?
My first memory of the young, like the infants, which I didn't like, they lunchtime I got put on, there was like a little window ledge, and they wouldn't let me sit at the table with the children. I had to sit on this window ledge, and I hated it. And obviously, I must have kicked up some form of stink when I was little, because the next thing I know, my sister, the one that's gone now, she used to come and get me, and we used to have our dinners in the classroom.
Right.
Yeah, we used to go and have dinners in the classroom. But then as I got older, and obviously she left, I wanted to eat the same. I wanted to be at the table with the children. And my dad come up with this great invention. At work, he said to the welder, he said, could you not put a ring around a fork and a spoon and weld it so that it could go on my finger? And I'll never forget, he come home with this fork and this spoon, and he said, try this. And I put it on my finger and I could eat at the table.
Wow.
And, you know, I don't think he realised. I'm thinking, wow. And I couldn't wait to go to school and, you know, get up that table the same as everybody else and eat the same as them, not having to take my shoes and my socks off.
Yeah,
it was wonderful.
Yeah.
So that's what I did in the end.
Yeah.
You know.
And did you have any, how did people react towards you as a children?
See, again, I can't ever, you know, I had a conversation with another thalidomide girl who was the same as me, and she said, did the kids never get hold of your sleeves and tie them round posts and that? And I was saying, No, never.
Yeah.
I mean, there might have been a few that might have, you know, said, oh, you've got no arms and that.
Yeah.
And I can remember the time when the school was saying, we're going swimming. And I thought, oh, my God, I've got to have a costume on now.
Yeah.
So that was a very hard thing.
Yeah.
But I had really good friends. They used to help me like anything, my friends.
Right, yeah.
But I still was very conscious of the top part of me. And I can always remember queuing up to go into the pool, and there was other schools. And I used to try and hide behind my friends so that they didn't see me.
Yeah.
And then once they went, it was fine. I wanted to get in that water.
Yeah, yeah.
The only thing I didn't like, they didn't want me to get straight into the water. They wanted to do something where I'd have armbands. So what they'd done, they got these bandages, put armbands. They looked like floaters tied to me.
Yeah.
And one of the teachers, it was a man teacher, he could see I wasn't happy because, again, I looked different, you see. And he said, you know what, I don't think Mandy will need them. He said, let's take them off her, which again, I think, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
And they did, and he encouraged me to swim.
Yeah.
And I did,
yeah.
You see.
Yeah.
I just never wanted to have anything different.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
It's like with the house, I never really wanted lots of adaptions, like a low kitchen. I just wanted to spend my life trying to do things normally,
yes,
like everybody else.
So
but yeah, my infants and junior school I absolutely loved. I'd done everything. You know, I wanted to play rounders. I could never definitely not play netball, and I really did hate that because I wanted to do netball, and there's no way I could do that.
I couldn't do either, and I've got arms.
Yeah,
so
tennis. I had about tennis. I used to put the tennis racket under my chin. But then when it came to going to the big school, the senior school, that's when things changed. Because I can remember thinking, oh, my God, there's other schools now that don't know me.
Yeah.
I then didn't want to get my finger out to eat. So then I started to go home for lunch. That's when my finger went away. I kind of got conscious, and I didn't want to wear short. I started to go into ponchos. And I think, when I think back now, I used to wear ponchos all the time, and I'm thinking, that was just me hiding. It was hiding. I don't now. Do you know what I mean? I'm so changed now.
Yeah.
When I think back, I always... And of course, ponchos wasn't always fashionable.
No.
So finding ponchos were very hard.
Yeah.
For 2 years, I stuck it at the big school, and I went back to wearing the arms, because I thought, no, I want to wear the arms. I don't want to keep getting to use my feet.
Yeah.
But it got tiring because, you know, the big schools had stairs. The arms were heavy. And I was getting very, very tired, and I wasn't enjoying being at the big school.
No.
So obviously my mum and dad